This is an oral history interview with Albert Moore, Salvation Army officer. The interviewer is Michael McKernan, and the date is 1st of May 1985. Albert, perhaps we could start by you just telling me where you were born and your background, where you grew up, where you were educated, and when you joined the Salvation Army.
Yes, Michael. To start off there, in the beginning, I was born at Collingwood in a Melbourne suburb on the 8th of March 1902. And I was educated at various state schools around the city of Melbourne. I left school when I was in about the fourth grade with very little education, really. And I was working at when I was 13 and a half, because I came from quite a big family. I can remember 9 in the family, and I remember my mum talking about 12 in all, and she had one or two other babes, which I don't know anything about. I'm the sole survivor of that large family, and I was, as I say, working from the age of 13 and a half.
What sort of work were you doing, Albert?
Well, various factory works, you know, wherever in those years when, work was plentiful. But
this would be while the First World War was on, wasn't it?
It would be.
Yeah.
Yes, it would be.
Yeah.
And then after the war had finished, and I was working in a shop in Bourke Street, Melbourne, when a lass came into the shop, and she'd been coming in for a few days from the Salvation Army headquarters, which was on the opposite side of Bourke Street, Melbourne. Mm-hmm. And she told me that I'd bumped her with a basket that I was carrying, and I apologised to her, and I was attracted to her, and I happened to say to her one day, "Well, you know, I'd like to take you out one night if it's okay with you." And she said, "Well, that'd be all right." And I said, "Well, where could we go?" I had lots of places in mind, quite different to her suggestion. So she said to me, "Well, you could take me to the Salvation Army Fair tomorrow night at South Melbourne." Oh, I wondered what I'd let myself in for. I thought, "Oh, Salvation Army, no way." But however, I was attracted to her, and so I agreed to go, which I did. And our association continued then for quite a few months, and I became more and more infatuated with her. I did my utmost to get her out of the Salvation Army.
Were you a religious person at all?
No, I wasn't. Mm. I'd never been in the Salvation Army Hall in my life prior to that, though I wasn't without my foundation in religion. My mum had sent we children in our childhood to the Church of England Sunday School, and until we got to a teenage, when we started to make our own decisions, we went along to St. Michael's in North Carlton, in Melbourne. And but then when my girlfriend, she would go and spend her time at the Salvation Army at South Melbourne every Sunday, and so, of course, to be with her, well, I went too, and I sat in the back of the hall. She was the pianist, and she would play the piano. And now, 83 years later, at least, I'm sorry, at 83 years of age, she still plays it at Palm Beach on the Gold Coast. And I couldn't get her out of the Salvation Army, and sitting in the back of the hall for so many months and hearing the message of salvation so often and so much, gradually I too came round to thinking as she was thinking. And ultimately, round about 1922, I would imagine, I joined the Salvation Army.
Now, When did you decide to become an officer?
Well, it was a bit later on than that, a few months later probably, and my girlfriend intimated that she would was thinking about going into the Salvation Army College, training college to become an officer. And I gave it a great deal of thought, and I felt too then, at this stage, that, well, I could go too. I was only a young Salvationist. She was born and bred in the Salvation Army, and I was only a young Salvationist. But the Salvation Army accepted me after a deal of questioning and examinations and so forth and so on. And we went into the training college session, which was called the Great Hearts, in 1924.
And you were still working in town, were you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Until we went into the training college.
Yes.
Well, in those days, the training session only lasted for a year.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that you'd left school so early, how did you take to study again? Was it?
Well, I found it very difficult. I used to sit up or get up in the early hours of the morning, perhaps 3 or 4 o'clock, and I would take my study books down into the dining room at the college, and I would study the lecture notes and everything else pertaining to what we were being taught and trying to learn, till it was time for reveille. And then I would go and resume just normal duties for the rest of the day.
Right. And when did you marry?
Well, we were commissioned as Salvation Army officers in 1925, January 1925. And we were both, my wife and I, were both appointed to corps in Tasmania. And then towards the end of the year, the senior officer in Tasmania needed a married couple for a particular corps, and he approached us as to the possibility of being married at the end of 1925. We felt that that was quite okay and very gratifying, and so we fixed the date for the 19th of December 1925.
Now, could you just briefly tell us some of the postings you had between 1925 and then the outbreak of war, because we'll get to your war record fairly quickly.
Yes, well, we had several postings in Tasmania.
Mm-hmm.
I was stationed at Lilydale and Scottsdale. My wife was stationed at Ulverston and Beaconsfield, and then we were married at the end of 1925, and in 1926 we were appointed as our first married corps to Ulverston, where my wife had been stationed as an assistant to another officer in 1925.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there we came back after 3 years in Tasmania. We were appointed to Castlemaine in Victoria, and then Maryborough. We also had appointments at other corps, and Redcliffe in Victoria and Broadford.
Mm. Did you enjoy the life?
Oh, yes. Mm. It was a life of self-denial. Mm. Financially, we were, it was very, very difficult. We were really battling to, sometimes put bread and butter on our table. And when our boy arrived on the 6th of February, 1929, it became more difficult because we had a baby to cater for. And the Salvation Army, unfortunately, in those days was not quite looked upon as it is today, when the motto, thank God for the salvos, is on everybody's lips.
Yeah.
And everybody is quite happy to
view. But surely some of the work you did in the Second World War, and even some of the work that Fighting Mac William Mackenzie did in the First World War, was responsible for that change of people's opinions and the high regard that Salvation Army's held in.
Oh, yes. Yes, you're right, Michael. Particularly, I think, after the Second World War, because I think the work... Fighting Mac was a padre.
Hmm.
And we who served in the Red Shield War Services in the Second World War had a much wider field of operation than a padre had.
We'll get to that point shortly, but let's now... the war broke out in September 1939. Now, did you volunteer to the Salvation Army to go into an army camp, or were you directed to go there?
No, I volunteered.
Well, why did you do that?
Excuse me. Mainly because all through the years I had a tremendous appreciation of the service and sacrifice of men of the armed services. And being a Salvation Army officer, I felt that, well, if I wanted to enlist, I would need to resign my officership of the Salvation Army, which I wasn't anxious to do. So if I could serve as a welfare officer, I would be very happy to do it. And I went into our headquarters in 69 Bourke Street and I told them very plainly that I would be very happy to serve as a welfare officer in the Red Shield War Services if our headquarters saw fit to give me that privilege.
And they did. It took some time, didn't it? When did you go to Geelong?
I went to Geelong in about October 1940.
That's right.
And I was there for... couple of months, probably.
Mm. What was the spirit in the camp like? Were the men keen to get abroad and to to get into the fight?
Oh yes, the men were all keen to become active service soldiers. They didn't find any pleasure apart from training in a static camp, and I found that the Australian soldier becomes very bored when he's in a static situation. He likes to be active.
And how did the men accept you? I mean, you were running a recreation hut, weren't you?
They were marvellous. Yes, they were marvellous. We had a recreation hut where the boys could come and write letters and get all sorts of help if it was necessary. And one or two occasions, boys would come to me. They were having difficulty with their wives. One boy in particular, I didn't have any success, but it wasn't for the want of trying. I went and interviewed his wife and talked to her and such like, but it was something that probably would have happened whether he'd been a soldier or not.
Was this your first time away from home?
It was, yes. I hadn't been away before.
And you that would have been a wrench for you?
It was a wrench, yes. I was always counting the cost, like every soldier, I imagine. Would do. The day would come when I would have to farewell from them.
Now you then accepted a posting with the troops abroad. This was offered by the Salvation Army, wasn't it?
That's right. I was told. In fact, when I was selected, I was told that I would move overseas at an early date.
So you left Melbourne in December 1940.
That's right, December the 28th. 1940,
sailed from Sydney, yes, that's right, yes. Now, what was your work on board the troop ship?
Well, the work became quite different. It was surprising, and this is what made the work so interesting. It was always changing and assuming different responsibilities and opportunities. When the men, particularly when the shores of Australia began to recede in the distance, men began to count the cost and start to ask themselves what they had done. And whilst I myself was as homesick as the next one, yet I would have men and even officers that would seek me out on the deck of the Queen Mary and they would lay bare their feelings so far as leaving home, their loved ones, and Australia as it receded into the distance was all being left behind.
But it cost you a great deal too, didn't it? Not only in terms of your own family, but in your diary, which I've had the privilege of reading, you show such an affection for Australia. I'm thinking of how you note in it how far each day you're moving away from Australia, and then, of course, when you come back to Australia, to see Australian land again, you really, in the diary, you write very fully about that and how pleased you are to be back. So you'd have to class yourself as a man who understood what the men were going through in being homesick and away from loved ones. And that must have helped your ministry with them.
Well, yes, it did, because I'm very human and I love Australia. I think Australia is the greatest land in the world. And I value it most highly. And I know that these men valued it just as highly as I did. And it sort of placed us on a level footing.
Mm. Now, you were in the on the Games Committee and so on, weren't you? You were in charge of entertainments on the troop ship.
That's right.
Organising boxing contests and concerts and those sorts of things. Did you have much opportunity for spiritual work amongst the men, or was your role pretty strictly their material well-being?
Oh, no. No, there was an abundant opportunity of spiritual work, which we placed first and foremost above anything else that we could do for the troops. The blessing that came to them from any comforts that we could hand to them, so far as face washer, which was one of the greatest blessings that you could give a man, because he could soak it in water and wash his face, and any other things that we might be able to give to them, was always second place to the needs of the men so far as spiritual things were concerned, because those outlived anything else that was material. I remember one of our officers, the name I mentioned to you a little while ago, Garnet Palmer, when he was going overseas and he was leaning over the rail of the deck on the ship that he went overseas with, and he started talking to one of the boys, and the boy said to him, you know, call him Padre, he said, you know, Padre, I want to come out of this clean because I've got to live with myself when the war finishes. And this is the case with many of these fellows, and our opportunity for spiritual work with them was just marvellous, one that I appreciated immensely. We would conduct church parades. I guess I've conducted as many church parades overseas in particular as the average padre would do.
Mm. How did you get on with the padres on the troop ship?
Oh, very good. Mm. Yes, we had a Padre MacPhail, who I think was Presbyterian.
Mm.
And there was another padre whose name I think just slips my mind at the moment. And a YMCA man whom I shared the cabin with, by the name of Brown. And we used to dine together in the dining room and discuss problems that might be affecting the men, that sort of thing. And of course, at that stage, homesickness was probably one of the greatest that we had to discuss with the men and try to encourage them and boost them up as best we could. But yes, Michael, the opportunities for spiritual work was immense.
Now, did you feel that it was your job to try to keep, you know, the morale up of the men in this first period of being away from home, so that you kept them as good soldiers? That your first obligation was to make sure that they were, you know, making a contribution for after what they were going to do, to be good soldiers, or did you feel that your responsibility was to each individual man and not so much to the army as a whole?
No, I felt that it was largely for each individual man. I think by catering for each individual man, on the whole, you're building up the morale of an army.
Mm.
If the morale of the men comes at a low level, then I think there's trouble everywhere.
Mm.
But when you can work on the basis of helping each individual man as best you can, I found that those opportunities came along, you know, in great quantity.
Now, how did the army officers accept you? Were you welcome as part of a team, or was your presence resented a bit? I've read material where First World War chaplains on the troop ship particularly felt that the officers wanted to keep them to one side and just allow them to work at the church parades on Sundays, but not to interfere with the general running of the ship during the week or get in the way too much. You know, that they were resented a bit. Did you find any of that?
No, I did not. I found the officers on 99% of occasions. I don't know where the odd 1% I could say existed, but I found that the officers were most cooperative and gave every assistance that they possibly can for all the work we were doing or trying to do for their men.
Mm-hmm.
I think they valued the fact that if we could help to keep the morale of their troops up, we were able to do something that they were not capable of doing.
Mm.
The yes. boys seemed to take it from us, accept a lot from us, that, they didn't expect to find coming from their officers.
There wasn't much, really, was there? If you look at the army today, you find all sorts of provision made in the terms of what would have been called then comforts, you know, in terms mm-hmm. of sporting equipment and, you know, recreational facilities and so on. But there wasn't really much provided for them directly by the army. I mean, the material things that you were providing were very necessary, weren't they?
Oh, they were, particularly under active service conditions. The things that we were able to provide was something that on most occasions weren't available anywhere else.
Mm.
And I remember in New Guinea, he was colonel at that time. He died just recently, Major General Sir F. Kingsley Norris. And he took me to task because he said I was always wanting to be right up on the front of the fighting, where he thought that I would do a better job back in the medical posts.
Mm.
Of course, he was in charge. His responsibility was the medical work.
Mm.
He was a medical man, not more or less a military man.
Mm.
He became a very warm friend of mine, as you would imagine from the pages that I sent to you recently. Mm. I wrote that story up for him, but he would have liked to have seen me serving further back. But I said to him at that time, and that was just down near Gona in New Guinea, and I said, well, Colonel, I feel that where I tried to work is the place where not even the military is able to do anything for these men. It's right on the front. There's no military machine to provide them with a cup of coffee or tea, face washer, or pencil and paper and envelope to write a letter home. I'm there to do that where nobody else is able to give it to them.
Mm, mm, mm.
And he accepted that.
Mm. All right, well, we'll get to New Guinea later on, but where did you land? You were on the Queen Mary. That was the first contingent to leave Australia, was it?
Oh, no.
No,
there were others that had gone before us. Yeah. I went mainly with 9th Div troops, and 6th and 7th Div, I think, had gone over before
that's
this,
right. Yes, that's
before
right.
I went.
Yes.
And we went from the Sydney Harbour to Colombo. Colombo, or Sri Lanka as it's known today. The Queen Mary couldn't get into Colombo Harbour, so she went up to a port up north of Colombo.
Mm-hmm.
And we transshipped there into smaller craft because of the dangers of the area that we were beginning to find ourselves in from there.
I remember that.
Down to Port Suez.
Yes, I remember that in your diary. You're a bit offended to have been taken off this glorious big ship
that's
and put
right.
in a bit of a tub, I think, you're in the next time,
right.
weren't you? Yeah,
that was quite likely that's in my diary, though. I found the service on the Lancashire, to which we transshipped, every bit as good as that on the Queen, only that the Queen was a so much bigger ship, but the service by those native waiters and all the other things that went with it, you couldn't complain about.
All right, now you went to Suez. Where'd you go from there?
Well, the night we arrived in Suez, the Germans laid bombs along the, at least the magnetic mines along the Suez Canal.
Mm-hmm.
We were due to land the following day. We were due to go up the canal.
Mm.
But these magnetic mines changed the story, and so we were there for a couple of days before we left the Lancashire, and we went up into Palestine by train. We travelled all night.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what were you in training there in Palestine?
In training?
Were you in training in Palestine?
Yes. It was all in training in that particular area.
Mm.
Around about Dimra, and just a few miles north of Gaza.
Mm.
And there were many camps there in which there were thousands of Australian troops that were always doing massive route marches, blistered feet, and all this sort of thing, preparing themselves for the days of battle.
Now, what was your work? What did you do in the camps? How did you try to organise your work there?
Well, there it was a matter of these recreation huts. When I arrived there, of course, they were well established, quite nice huts, well equipped with tables, chairs, writing material, everything that men wanted to spend a leisure hour or two, and we would make them a cup of coffee at night.
Why was it coffee? Wouldn't Australians have preferred tea?
Well, when I say coffee, it could quite easily be tea, but for some uncanny reason, we would have used a much greater quantity of coffee than tea. I don't know why, but that was the case, that where it was possible for us to have coffee, you know, we would use coffee.
Yeah. So you'd brew up some coffee after dinner sometime, and the men had come in and have a cup of coffee and have a bit of a yarn and a bit of a relax.
Mm. Yeah.
And they were in fixed huts. When did you buy the famous bus that became your hallmark?
Well, we moved down to the Western Desert. That was we arrived in the Western Desert on Good Friday, 1941. Now, can I tell you what happened on the train?
Yes.
As I tell the ladies this morning, there was a chappie who became my helper, Jock Ingalls, and Jock was anxious to become, which is officially known in military circles as Batman, but most of officers looked upon their Batman as friends and helpers, and Jock was just that. He'd been a bandsman of ours at a town in Victoria, Redcliffs. And
had you known him before the war?
Oh yes, he was, as I say, he was a bandsman of ours at Redcliffs in Victoria, up on the Murray River. And he had enlisted and joined up, and he'd gone with the 14th Battalion, was in Palestine when I arrived there. And his ambition was, of course, to link up with me and become my helper, officially on military records as Batman.
Mm.
And when we moved on, we entrained from Dimra in Palestine, as I said, a few miles north of Gaza, just about sundown on this particular day. And as we moved down through Beersheba on the Sinai Desert, one of the officers in my carriage, there were 22 carriages in the train and a few trucks which were loaded with troops, an officer happened to mention that he was ill, and I happened to say to him, "Would a cup of tea help you?" And he looked at me as though it was an ill-timed joke. He just wasn't able to understand why I would suggest that under these circumstances a cup of tea could be provided. And Jock had told me what he had packed into my pack before we got on the train. So I knew that there were the facilities there for making a cup of tea. There was a tin with a little primer stove in it. He put in my pack a bottle of kerosene and a little bottle of methylated spirits and matches and biscuits and tea and a little kettle. And so this man didn't answer me, and I repeated the offer to him. He looked really ill, and he said, "Yes, if it can be procured," he said, "where would you get a cup of tea and a thing like this?" So I took the pack down off the rack, and in the restricted area and in the fading light, I unpacked this little primer stove and set it going, emptied my water bottle into the little kettle, and in no time I handed this man a cup of tea. Now, I was an unknown quantity, as you was asking me before how officers accepted you. I was an unknown quantity in the division, the brigade and the battalion to which I was operating. But because of the Salvation Army, you were halfway there already.
Mm.
Because they felt, well, if you belong to the Salvation Army, well, you were okay.
Mm.
And they accepted us. And in no time, there was a cup of tea for this man, and the other officers in the carriage emptied their water bottle into the little kettle, and they had a cup of tea. The only occasion, which answers another question of yours about the cooperation of officers, there was a man, a high-ranking officer in the battalion, who was the 2IC at the time, and he had said to me earlier when I first joined the battalion, "Don't look to me for any help, because no help will be forthcoming." And I didn't know why, because he was quite a nice type of chappie, and I had no occasion to ask him for anything. However, he passed along the corridor while these officers were drinking a cup of tea. Oh, and his eyes popped out almost like organ stops. And he said, "Where'd you fellas get that?" So I said to him, "Well, sir, if you can bring along your water bottle, we might be able to give you a cup of tea." And he did just that. And he went back to his carriage with a cup of steaming hot tea, which tickled him pink. And the rest of the men in his compartment then, they brought their water bottles.
So you had a real business on
and
your hands.
They had a cup of tea until finally the little primer stove petered out.
Yeah.
And that was it for that effort.
Of course, that's an interesting story because it shows you as such a practical person. I mean, and all through your diary, and as I hope we'll explore in this interview, you're a very practical man. I mean, you could turn things on where the conditions didn't seem to be right, or you know anybody else would have found it too hard. How did you get that sort of background? I mean, what is there in you that enables that to happen?
I don't know, Michael, but. The strange thing in my life where, now that I'm getting to the stage of being an old man, perhaps it's fading, but years ago when people would say it can't be done or it's impossible, there seemed to be something in me that sort of made me feel, well, you know, try and reverse that, see if it can be done.
Mm.
And in several experiences in the Red Shield, when we went up to Tripoli and I was told that I couldn't do any work much there because I couldn't take my motor vehicle into the mountains, there were no roads. And I said, "Well, how do the men, they've got to be fed, how do you get tucker to them?" And well, it was a mule train. And I said, "Well, okay, what about a couple of meals for the Red Shield?" And I had to hammer and hammer and hammer on the door of military red tape to get a couple of mules allotted to me. Then in New Guinea, at a later stage, it was impossible to get native carriers to work on the Kokoda Trail. And so I said, "Well, what's wrong with native carriers for the Salvation Army?" Oh, and Ned Kelly on the Kokoda Trail liaison, who handled native carriers, he told me it's just impossible. He said, "We haven't got enough to carry supplies and munitions and all that sort of thing over the Kokoda Trail." Somebody told me of a 2nd 14th Battalion officer who was now working on Angau, and Vin James. So they said, "He's on Angau now, why not go along and see Vin?" So I went along and saw Vin, and Vin said, "Oh, Albert," he said, "this is one of the biggest tasks that I've been asked to do, but he said, I'll go and see the boss and see what I can do. Well, Vin came back out and he said, well, the chief has agreed to you having one carrier a day. Now, that was a breakthrough, and I said, well, look, Vin, I won't want a carrier a day, but if I could get 12 or 15 to carry a supply of comforts, I could do something. So he went back to the chief, and he came back anyhow with authority for me to do that. He didn't mention any number, but he gave me a note. And on the note he said to Ned Kelly, liaison Kokoda Trail, please, Ned, do what you can for Albert Moore. No man has done more for the Australian soldier than this fellow. And when I went back to Ned after him saying there was no hope, he almost turned pale. And he said, this is, something I never foresaw. And, okay, I got the native carriers and we left on the Kokoda Trail with those boys loaded with comforts, which were a great blessing when we got through to Myala.
That's because your reputation had preceded you to New Guinea.
That's somewhat the character of the case, yes.
So let's now look at how you won that reputation in the Middle East. We've mentioned the bus a couple of times. You decided that if you were to do your work with the troops mobile, you'd need to be very mobile yourself. So you managed to get a bus. Tell us the story of that.
Well, I came when we were in the Western Desert at Mirza Matru. I said to the CO, or the adjutant, that they'd give me the leave necessary. I'd go up to Alexandria and I'd try and contact our chief, who was a man by the name of Ralph Satchell, comes from Sydney, and see what I could do to get a mobile, because we needed it badly. The CO had made available to us a utility which we were using to take coffee around, and also Padre Pat Whelan, the Roman Catholic priest, a thorough gentleman. And we were doing things that way. Well, then we went up to... I went to Alexandria, and I managed to get in touch with Ralph Satchell, and the outcome of that visit was that Ralph managed to get from the... New South Wales Golfers Association enough money to buy a station wagon in Alexandria. And after looking around quite a bit, we got onto a very fine station wagon, beautiful vehicle, which was, the bodywork was polished wood. I've never seen anything like it by either before or since. At the end of its service in New Guinea, there was fungus growing out of all this woodwork because of the climatic conditions in that area. And we used that. It was a station wagon that had a tailboard that dropped down at the back on chains. And we were able to put our urns of coffee on this at Mirza Matru when we went up over the sandhills.
Mm-hmm. How much did you pay for the station wagon?
Oh, it was about £350.
Was it new or second hand?
No, it was second hand.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it had done quite a bit of work. In fact, as we got John Hocking, one of our representatives, and went with me to Alexandria to purchase this vehicle or try to get a vehicle, and as we were just approaching Mirza Matru, we thought we'd been shot when the front tyre blew out.
Yeah. Had you driven much before?
Oh yes, I'd been driving for quite a few years as a Salvation Army officer.
Right. Yeah. So you didn't have any difficulty with that, and you could handle the local conditions?
Oh yes. Yes, it was a left-hand drive vehicle. I called it, had the name printed on the front of it, Vikel.
Yeah.
The first syllable of my wife's name and my boy's name, Vi and Kel.
Yeah.
And
this showed, of course, that you still had them in your thoughts.
Oh,
a
yes,
great deal.
I did.
Yeah.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. Were you getting regular letters from them?
Very often. Once I got established in the 2nd 14th Battalion, mail came fairly regularly.
Mm-hmm.
But prior to that, you'd go for quite long periods before your mail would be moving round from area to area.
Mm.
Quite a bit of mail from Australia would be just labelled AIF abroad, and they just wouldn't know where to look you up.
Mm. So you bought the wagon, and now you're able to take coffee and cake and biscuits around to the men wherever they were posted.
Yes, well, at Merseytree, they were in dugouts, and you had to travel over a wire mesh laid over the sandhills, so just like lots of the sandhills on our beaches around Australia. And the wire mesh was fastened down with wire 4 or 5 feet from the mesh itself, and then with long spikes driven into the ground. And I surveyed the area and got an idea just where the men were located. We were doing this between Merseytree and Saloon. Now, the Germans were holding Saloon at that particular time. And I would take an umpire's whistle, and we'd pull up at various spots. Travel in the dark, of course, you couldn't have any lights. We'd pull up at various spots and I'd blow this umpire's whistle. There wouldn't be a boy to be seen, but like rabbits out of burrows, they would come out of their foxholes and they'd come over to the bus, quite a number of them, for a drink of coffee and a slice of cake or a biscuit. And we had a gramophone, which Jock used to put a record on, and he'd play various Australian records and tunes and that sort of thing. And the boys would, and we'd turn on the radio, we'd make it... tried to organise it so that we reached different positions when the BBC News was coming over, and they'd hear Big Ben chime out, and then the BBC announce the news, and that would keep them in touch with just what was happening.
And how many cups of coffee were you serving a night at this stage, do you think?
Oh, we would take, 30, 40 gallons. The urns held about 10 gallons each, and oft times we would go back to replenish the supply.
Mm-hmm. How did you keep them hot?
Well, we covered them with blankets. They were urns I bought in Alex when we got the bus. I went round to various tin makers, etc., and we didn't have any of the modern equipment that was available in later stages of the war.
Yeah.
And we'd cover these urns with blankets to try and keep them hot. But the boys didn't worry. They could drink it to cold, you know, and the conditions of the desert, of course. I think I recorded in my diary that the man who wrote The Sands of the Desert Grow Cold was never in the Western Desert, because I never knew them, you know, to be hot. Every night was chilly.
Yeah. Obviously, the men really started to look forward to your coming. I mean,
they did. It
would have been a regular event.
Yes.
I suppose you must have felt a lot of pressure then to keep going. I mean, there must have been times when you were exhausted or you weren't feeling too well or something like that, but you felt you had to keep going?
No. No, I think the fact that you were doing a service that was appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
One boy, I remember one night, John Hocking, as I mentioned before, John came with me. He was with the 25th Brigade. He'd been with the 21st Brigade before I went to it, and because of problems that he had there, he asked for a move, and he went to the other brigade. But he came with me this night. He said, "Albert, I'll come with you, just see what you're doing." And he came with me, and while he was standing there, and he was helping to serve the coffee and give the boys a bit of cake and that sort of thing, one boy came to him and he said, "Oh, Dad told me I'd find the Salvos doing this sort of thing." Now, he was only a lad of 18 or 19 years of age. And that was a great blessing. And while we were doing it, I noticed a tear in John's eyes as he saw the boys, how they appreciated this cup of coffee, living in those conditions.
Now, were other Salvation Army officers doing this sort of thing too, or were you able to to really invent a form of service that was unique to yourself, was it?
No, John Hocking was there. He was down in the more in the town area of Merseytrew with his men. But John wasn't able to do nearly the type of work. Well, the vehicle was bought really to be used by John and myself, but John saw what I was doing and he said to me, look, Albert, you take the vehicle. If I need it, I'll come and get it. But John didn't. He felt that we were quite happy, doing the job and to leave it go on that way.
Mm-hmm. So how long were you there in the desert?
We were there for about 8 weeks, thereabouts, when the call came to go back to Palestine. We used to finish up of a night. If we had any coffee surplus, we'd drive down along the Mediterranean beach, and we'd get South African boys down there who were on anti-aircraft guns and that sort of thing.
Mm.
And we used to supply them with a cup of coffee, and they thought it was great too.
Mm.
They enjoyed it.
I bet.
One night we were coming back along the beach when we had a head-on collision.
Yeah.
With a military vehicle. It was still mobile and able to take us back to where to leave our mobile there.
Yeah.
But
you had a bit of trouble with the bus, didn't you? I mean, it served you tremendously well. Goodness knows how many miles you did in it eventually. But you're always having prangs or scrapes or...
Yes.
And you had a lot of trouble getting it repaired at one stage.
That's right, because the conditions... See, most of what we were doing, we had to operate in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
So close to the enemy lines that you couldn't use lights.
Mm-hmm.
And the military vehicle that the CO, Colonel George Cannon, made available to me, that ran into problems too, going over the wire mesh. It was caught up in some of these spikes and ripped the mudguards
mm-hmm.
off. And the same thing happened to our vehicle almost the first night that we went out.
Mm.
And then the crash on the beach, and that became a problem. And there was a workshops, military workshops at Merseytrew in the middle of the desert. And I went along to the CO and told him about the crash. And well, he's had a breakdown vehicle out and picked up the bus and brought it into the workshops, and there was a fully operational workshops there.
Mm.
They could handle anything. And he said it would be about 48 hours before he could have it mobile, which he did. And but when I went back to pick it up, the workshops had gone, lock, stock and barrel. There wasn't a thing there. The only thing that was there was my mobile.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, they've gone away. They mightn't have even repaired it.
Huh?
The axle was bent and all this sort of thing. Well, I got in. I found the keys in the ignition and I switched it on and away she went.
Huh?
But it was still without a tire and tube. And that, in the middle of the Western Desert, well, you needed a miracle to happen to get one.
Yeah.